dear listeners, and yes, it is another week of the podcast. This week, I interview Amy Wong Hope. And yes, I admit it. I'm going to say it again. I have another super groovy guest for you. But really, all you need to do is hop on over to her website, resilientwithin.com, just to see that I am speaking the truth. Amy is involved in a lot of cool stuff. But right now, what's super exciting for me, and I'm sure for her as well, is that Southwestern College here is starting a program here of psychedelic studies. And Amy's creating and crafting those courses that are going to be offered to nurses, doctors, social workers, clergy, anyone that kind of wants to understand and potentially include plant medicines in their therapy work, in the work they're doing in the world. Amy has lots of other incredible things going on in her life, a super fun TikTok channel. She has a book that she's published that she talks about a little bit later in our podcast. But what really caught me this week was how we talk about how trauma and cultural expectations, the stories that people tell us, how they kind of create this lacquer on all of us as individuals. And over the course of our lives, if we're lucky enough, if we're strong enough and determined enough, over time we can kind of scrape and chisel away at that lacquer to find our true selves, those selves that we keep hidden from the world and that are really just clamoring to be let out. This conversation was very dynamic and very fun, and I hope you love and appreciate it as much as I did. So now, episode 134, and my interview with Amy Wong Hope.
And when what she told me and what she showed me is her birth. She showed me what it looked like in the room when she was born. And she said, I came out and I saw it through her eyes. And this transmission was so real. It wasn't even words spoken to me. It was a knowing that what she experienced in that moment of being born was that she was not wanted because she was a girl. And inside her own consciousness at that moment, her first thoughts at that time, her first feelings were, I better be useful.
I would love to hear how you self-describe. If you had to go to a conference or introduce yourself to someone or a group of people, how do you introduce yourself? Who are you as a human being?
Okay. This is always a hard question because I just was at the Psychedelic Science Conference in Denver, Colorado. And so I would describe myself as a clinician educator at this point in time. However, I am a full-time clinician with a full private practice where I take a lot of insurance. I take mostly insurance clients because I like the spectrum of people I meet through that. And my area is really, I have a strong background in treating the neurobiology of trauma and attachment. And I like to really cultivate shame resilience and resilience in living their lives back to or whatever they would orient to consider wholeness for themselves. So that's been always my primary area of focus. But then I also am now a clinician educator for Southwestern College in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which is a counseling master's and doctoral program. And I am founding a psychedelic studies certificate program that is for the graduate students and also for community members who are either master's level clinicians in any of the healthcare fields, clergy, doctors. I want to invite clergy, doctors, and policymakers into it. So I really, that's my next piece is to invite those folks into it. And I now am a co-author of a book called Small Doses of Awareness, A Microdosing Companion, which will be published by Chronicle Books in February of 2024. And this is a guided companion journal for those people who are interested in exploring and guiding their own microdosing journey. And I wrote it with my co-author, Xinyi Pei, who is a very well-known author in the Seattle area. And she approaches it from the creativity side. I approach it from the psychotherapy side, but we both really look at questions of identity and undoing conditioned identities in the process of microdosing over a 90-day period.
Yes, congratulations on the book. That's amazing. I loved that you sent it to me. The cover's beautiful. And I think it's a super exciting premise. It really encourages people to thoughtfully engage with the journey that they're going on, but also, you know, I think magically engage with it too, through creativity and their own experience. You know, because certainly, of course, I know many, many people who engage with plant medicines in ways that are to party, quote unquote, you know, without any thoughtful reverence or, and maybe that's where they are in their life at that point, but there is also the potential for another kind of journey over time, which is more considerate and potentially holds more promise of healing or unvarnishing all the lacquer that you were talking about. Because lacquer's hard. I don't know. I'm sure you know that. It's like hard. It's like some sort of armor that is so hard to get off. And I think it's the perfectly beautiful kind of metaphor for the conditioning that, yes, you know, our parents, our greater society, you know, our culture, they all put on us, mm-hmm, you know, so long ago. I thought this was really interesting. I had a conversation with a channeler who was very well known in California. And, you know, after the guides came in and they started talking to me, they said, oh my gosh, we just want to tell you, you are wearing the most amazing dress. It is so beautiful. And it's, but you're a child. So we see you as a child and there's this dress and it has brocade and it has gemstones and it has ornate stitching and it's just all over the dress. And it's the most beautiful dress that we've ever seen a child wear.
Wow.
But you can't move in it. It's so heavy that you can't move. And they said, what kind of dress do you think a child should be wearing? And I said, I don't know, like a shift dress, maybe, like that you can dance in and play in. And they said, exactly. And they said, all of that beautiful stuff that's on that dress, it's all the stories people have told you and the things that your parents imparted to you, your friends, your culture. Those are all things that they told you because they thought they would be helpful to you, but they're now on you and weighing you down. So it's going to take a lot of work and it's going to be so painful. It's going to hurt so very deeply, but you need to get into the other dress.
Oh.
And I just thought, good God.
Got some work.
Yes, I have some work, but I think it's, you know, I think it's important to recognize that, you know, I just thought that metaphor was so apt for me.
Yes.
And, you know, every time I go through something painful, like when I walked the Camino and my foot was really hurting me or my knee was really hurting me, I was like, is this what they were talking about? Is this the pain? But I think the pain was of course the Camino, but it's been a lot of other things since then.
Because if I put some arnica on that, is that, yeah, mean not shedding the layer?
It's over. But I think it's important to recognize that, yes, we're all carrying these stories and these assumptions and these, you know, if we've been really hurt, whether the stories are from someone else, like a parent, or ones that by observation we've created by looking at the world, you know, they're on us, they're in us.
Yeah.
And it's so essential to, and it's, I mean, gooey, icky work to go in there and unpack it, and painful, but it's necessary, right? if you want to not be wearing the heavy dress or whatever you've created, that armor that right. you're carrying around. It's so important. And so I'm so grateful for the work you do, because I didn't understand until I, of course, saw Brené Brown, along with the rest of humanity, how powerful shame is, and yes. just how people use it as a weapon to control other people, or even as a malignant sort of enjoyable device to hurt other people. It is so powerful, and we carry it forever, you know?
It's part of systemic racism, right? It's a system of shame. And those systems and those identities that people are expected or conditioned to inhabit. Because yeah. what? Because of what? How did that get created? Right? How did that created the power and power over and those that are submissive to it?
Yeah.
And those who are conditioned are in the submissive position.
Yeah.
And they don't even realize it, right? They don't even realize it. And so this is really the whole social justice movement and why it's so hard for people to give up or to acknowledge that they do have privilege, they do have power. Even me as a Chinese American woman, I have certain privileges because of my appearance. Absolutely, I see that. And those I really am thankful to all of the activists, scholars, and researchers who have published and spoken out through the years, because they really are evolving our whole humanity, I think, at this point in time.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I've told so many people over the years that, and it wasn't until seminary that I understood this, but me growing up in these different countries that I grew up in, you know, Pakistan and Guyana, and just being confronted with, but also traveling all over the world and meeting people from all different cultures and belief systems. And, you know, when you're in a child, that's such a powerful experience, because first you understand, oh, we're all the same, essentially, you know, at heart, you know, mm-hmm. and, but also there are many, many different legitimate ways of doing things. And just because you might not agree with it doesn't take away how sacred and beautiful the way this person engages with whatever, you know, their food, their God, whatever that looks like. But also it was an inordinate amount of privilege to be able to witness that and learn from it and just see the amount of poverty that people lived in, but still they were resilient and living. You know, to be confronted by that as a child was pretty earth-shattering. And then we moved back to the Midwest, Illinois, where everything is kind of Wonder Bread and peanut butter. For me, it broke my heart, but also was a huge gift
yeah.
to be a witness.
Sure.
And yes. that's privilege, you know?
You're open to seeing it and letting yeah. it affect your heart, right? The humanity you could feel inside of yourself connected. That their humanity was completely disregarded, right? That they don't have the same opportunities.
It just broke my heart to come back to the Midwest. It was just like such culture shock and so heartbreaking and weird. I mean, it was such an alien thing for me that in seminary, I understood, wow. I mean, I had a lot of heartbreak, but that was my first big heartbreak, was coming back to Illinois. And as a child, suddenly having to change and conform. And if you wanted to survive, you had to become this kind of Stepford sort of child. But anyway, that's a whole other story. Well, I would love to hear, did you grow up in a religious household, or how did your family engage with that?
Well, I did not grow up in a religious household at all. Actually, my father immigrated to the United States when he was 12 years old, and he was separated from the rest of his family until he was about 18 years old. And he came through Canada, through Toronto, Quebec, Montreal, and then eventually rejoined his family when he was about 18 years old. First language he spoke in North America was really French before English. So here you have this Chinese guy with a French speaking, you know, French and with a Chinese accent, right? My father had the thickest Chinese accent ever. But anyways, because of what my father had gone through in China and the family immigrating to the United States, he would frequently say to me, "You kids romanticize what China was like," because we were used to the Disney World Epcot version of China. We were used to Chinatown, Boston, China, and, you know, like pastry shops and going to dim sum and seeing our grandparents and, you know, getting the chicken and all the yummy stuff that are hanging up in the windows, right? And my father said, no, we were starving. And because of the Cultural Revolution and what he had witnessed, he did not want to practice any religion or any religious things in our household. So I think really the first religion I really grew up with, which I was very fortunate, is I was born in Boston and we moved to Cape Cod when I was 4 years old, and my father opened restaurants there. And I moved from being in the big city, where I remember being a very unhappy child. Actually, I remember it almost like in The Wizard of Oz, it was black and white. Remember before Dorothy gets swept up and then she lands in the land of Oz and it's all Technicolor. Well, that's how Cape Cod felt to me. Technicolor. And I became best friends with my next door neighbor. My next door neighbor was a boy 2 years younger than me. His name is Darren. And Darren became my best friend. We became best friends and we were fishing every day, catching salamanders, frogs. We were everything, building forts. You know, I think we were using power tools and like buzz, you know, things that you shouldn't use at that age. We're 8 years old, right? So we were cutting down trees and things like that to make our forts. But I seriously believe that if my family had not moved to Cape Cod, I would have been a very seriously depressed teenager. I'm very, very seriously depressed because I had many, many mystical experiences there, many miracles there. The vividness, I can see certain memories from that period of time of fishing in our pond and sitting in a tree with Darren. All day long, we would sit there and sometimes we'd go swimming or sometimes we'd be fishing and we'd sit in this tree that hung over the pond and we would watch for this big bass that we always wanted to catch. But the big bass was always too smart to bite on our hook. No matter what bait we used, no matter what lure we used, it didn't matter. And the feeling of seeing that water and how clear it was and that big bass or the other sunfish swimming up and checking things out just really stuck with me and was really, thank goodness, my medicine, because it changed me radically.
I think there's something extremely powerful about being a child in nature. And especially if you connect with a certain, you know, it sounds like you connected with the fishing hole, you all connected with that tree. I mean, the way you're describing it, I can see it in my mind's eye and it just sounds so idyllic and so beautiful. And when we're kids, of course, also, there were no cell phones. I think that's important right. too. So as kids, I think it's easier to kind of, downshift and fully occupy that experience, especially if it's in nature in a way where that entire, you know, maybe how the air smelled, the flick of the fish's fins on the water, the shimmer of the ripples on, it's like that memory, you're just right there.
That's right.
And it's imprinted. And that, I think, itself is some kind of magic, you know?
Yes. And I think there's such a conditioning to do in our modern culture that back then, I feel lucky that I got to grow up in that era of the 70s where we didn't have all this meta speak about how to do self-care. We were just in it. We had the time and space to actually do that sort of thing. I mean, as a child, I did. I feel like children today, there's so much more pressure on them because of our society, right?
I mean, I'm not a parent, but yes, I mean, it's the amount of pressure on kids these days, whether it's from the ugliness of social media and their peers to the parents wanting them to achieve, to girls wanting to be thin or look like a certain celebrity. I mean, it's astonishing how much pressure is on kids these days. I give thanks every day that I grew up in the 70s and the 80s. Because there was none of that crap.
Yes.
We just could be. We could just.
Well, there was a ton of that crap, actually. Do you remember? Do you remember slathering yourself in baby oil and putting yourself out in the sun?
I mean, I was overseas, so we didn't do that.
But here in the States, right, we were listening to Donna Summer. We were listening to Donna Summer. She works hard for the money. And coming up with our dance routines, you know, as young, you know, right. And I always thought it was very strange because my neighbor, one of my other neighbors was a girl, and she was more acculturated to being a girl. And so I thought it was weird to kind of do these dance routines because I didn't understand the body motions and things like that because she understood all that. How to position herself as a girl. So when I entered girl world at age 12, I was like, what is this? This is not fun. And that's another place where all those layers of lacquer started to build up as well, for sure. I've definitely had times like these miracle times, like in nature. And then I've had those times where the conditioning of, or what the context I was entering into, it didn't feel like there was really a choice of what I was entering into, right? You're entering into girl world, being a teenager, 12, 13 years old, and that confusion about what was that thing that I lived through that felt so free and so much space to this, and you're cultivating a certain image. And that was very common, very, very common. So I think no matter, you know, you experienced that when you came back to the United States, though.
I mean, when I came back to the States, it's interesting. It was amazing being overseas because, again, I was with kids from all over the world and we went to go play with each other. There wasn't all this, what are you wearing? What color is your skin? Like, let's just have fun. Like, let's play soccer or whatever. And then I came back to the States, and I've talked about this in other podcasts. It was so weird to me. I mean, I remember the teacher brought out the old, my God, projections, you know, thing. And she's making the click and clacking sound. The film's like click and clacking. And it was a whole movie about like 5 minutes about us versus them. And there were kids who were holding us signs and kids who were holding them signs. And it was about engaging and tolerating and appreciating other people who were different. And I just sat there and I was like, this is the weird, this is the weirdest thing I've ever seen. Even as a kid, I was like, I don't know why they're showing this to us. Cause it like doesn't make any sense. Like what, where is this happening? Yes. And then I found out very soon where it was happening, all around me.
Wow. Wow.
And it was just this kind of this strange revelation that I was not in Kansas anymore. And it was when like the lacquer started being put on me because there were all these different ways that I had to behave and act. And even for my parents, you know, there's a lot going on at home that was like, not great. Mm. And yeah, I mean, I had a very, very intuitive and deep connection with the natural world when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, would it's hard to explain. I just could connect with it. But then over the years, all this stuff started piling on and I had to disengage so that I could be quote unquote normal, or maybe quote unquote, not cause my mom problems or whatever. So, and I was so creative and artistic when I was a kid. And then I had to put all that away just so I could survive. Yeah. And, so when I was in seminary and I took the 700 question thing about who are you? And it, the first thing it came back with was artist. I was like, oh, I'm going to throw up in the corner over there because that is effed up. What is happening? The second one was science and technology, but that's because I love science magazines. I love that ever since I was a kid, but that idea that I was an artist made me physically ill because there was no time for that. It was never legitimate. It was never, you know, growing up, it was not a real thing. And I thought, oh, God. Now I've slowly worked on it and sort of semi-reconciled, but you know, understanding that, you know, when you're a kid, sometimes you have to put away a secret part of yourself. Like to survive, you have to hide.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. That is exactly what I have done. I've done it over and over and over, right? I almost call it like a process of forgetting who we are. And I forgot for many years. And then I went to college. And then somehow in college, I was very lucky. I got exposed to a comparative religion class. And that was where my studies into consciousness really started. It was with Dr. Payden up at University of Vermont, who had founded with several others. And they were really all from the 60s. They were part of that generation. And what they were talking about is comparative religion and the study of phenomenology, which is what is the meaning to the beholder? What is the meaning to the meaning maker? And all of a sudden, everything I've been saying, this was in my junior year or my senior year, I finally got exposed to this. And I was like, oh my goodness, this is what I want to study. This is what I want to study. Because I had realized through many experiences, I mean, even though I'm Chinese American, I don't speak Chinese. My parents did not raise me to speak Taishanese, which is a dialect of Cantonese. They raised us to speak all English so we would have no accent. They were part of the assimilation generation. And so I had always felt either not white enough in my school, because I was one of three Asian kids in my school, or not Chinese enough because I couldn't speak Chinese, even though I will eat anything from my heritage that my friends would be horrified, you know, when they'd come over to dinner when I was a kid, right? And so when I realized that some realizations I'd come to about my being Chinese in a white world and being not Chinese enough in a Chinese world, that I realized that who is the person and what is the meaning they make? Do they regard the other person as a human first, or do they regard the other person as one of the labels they've labeled them first? And so this study of phenomenology made so much sense to me. So then, of course, I graduate from college, right? And I go into the corporate world and I become a technical editor. Well, first I became a programmer. I was programming HTML pages. I created the first website for Addison Wesley Longman, their like publishing list. I became a programmer after that. I became a tech support engineer after that, super techie. Then I became a developmental editor, a technical editor who was writing for them. And I've been doing that for years, all up through my mid 30s, right? And then I woke up one day and I was like, wow. If I'm still doing this by the time I'm 50, I'm going to probably not be very happy. And I woke up and I said, okay, I was 34 at that time. And I started to go, I still heard the theories from my phenomenology program study, because I ended up double majoring in English literature and comparative religion. And I combined the two, because they're very similar in terms of looking at what are the themes, what is the meaning, to the protagonist, right, in the story? What is the meaning? You can really do a study of phenomenology in a lot of the great novels. And I ended up looking into all sorts of different programs and choosing to become a social worker because the person who was running Simmons School of Social Work was also a comparative religion person. And when I explained to them why I wanted to come back and become a social worker, they said, that makes sense. Every other program looked at me cross-eyed. Why would you want to go from being in high tech, what you're doing, to becoming a psychotherapist? Because what was really interesting to me is what causes people to wake up and change.
I sometimes say that it's a divine bitch slap.
That's a good one. It is. It is usually right. Suffering is that divine bitch slap, right?
Yes.
And the point is, I think suffering is really due to those years of conditioned lacquer. And that conditioned lacquer, if we can understand that that is the suffering that we are living under, it's like we're living under all those layers, like we can't even almost see through. And so what gets reinforced is living within the lacquer. And so it takes painstaking mindfulness, integration, right? So here it is, right? I'm teaching a psychedelic studies course. The big buzzword is integration. Well, what is it to reintegrate who you were when you knew who you were before all the conditioning started? And that's what I'm really interested in. I've always been really interested. So people will ask me all the time, they say, don't you get exhausted having a full caseload and, you know, hearing about, you know, your client's trauma and working with that? And I said, no, because it is to me ultimately so fascinating to walk beside my clients and see what they're doing, where they are in that process for themselves.
Well, and who knows who's going to create the next Red Book? We need more of those.
Right. One needs to be written for this time period.
Absolutely. I mean, I know everyone says that Jung descended into quote unquote madness for 18 years or whatever it was. And that's when he created the Red Book. But I wish one didn't have to descend into madness to create something beautiful and revelatory and mystical, a mystical text. Or maybe I wish that the mystical experience wasn't considered out of this world or an anomaly.
That's right. Well, and maybe it's more considered out of this world an anomaly in our Western context, right? And maybe Jung descending into madness is him descending into something opposite than the conditioned world considers reality. So who's defining madness? Again, we think about dominant, right? Who is defining what? It's the dominant culture, the dominant population, right? So who's defining what madness is? I mean, even for myself, you know, as I start to create this next curriculum, and I only have usually 10 weeks between each course to create, you know, research, write, and create my presentation for each of these 2-day weekend, these 16 hours I teach every 10 weeks, right? Right now I'm starting on the history of the psychedelic movement, you know, just history of psychedelic movement, 16 hours, just got to create 16 hours of content. And I am fighting my own conditioning to feel like I don't have enough time to do it. And then I wonder to myself, am I being unreasonable when I take the extra time to actually say to myself, oh, I'm going to go spend time in nature for 5 hours instead of doing the reading that I feel like I should be doing? You hear the should in there, right? I'm shooting all over myself, right?
Well, I'm thinking about that class. And, you know, what I find so intriguing and fascinating about teaching and imparting knowledge and introducing people to new concepts or new paradigms is it's all storytelling, right? So you're essentially a storyteller. And yes. I think that's exciting.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely. One of my totem animals is a spider. They show up everywhere for me. Sometimes I say, even though you're my totem, can you not show up in my shower right now? When they show up or when I'm in my bed or something like that. but yes, the weaving and also the background of being a literature major and being a developmental editor, one of the paradigms, and it's one of the many metaphors. I like to use metaphor a lot with my clients. They know this. But I also like to think about it. I like to find out what metaphor is most powerful for them in their, when it's around a crux point or something difficult that they're undoing for themselves. Or doing, right? There's an undoing and doing. It's the doing, right? Can be hard too. and I do think that story and narrative can be extraordinarily powerful because it can guide one in their own way, right? When they find their own metaphor, then they're listening to their own inner guide. And I'm just there asking questions or facilitating or, you know, reflecting back to them. Right. And then also too, in creating the story about the psychedelic movement, I've been thinking the themes I want to go towards are what is the motivation? What was the internal pulse that caused this person, Shulgin or Albert Hoffman, to do what they did at those crux moment of time in times when they were creating their compounds, right? Or others when they choose to research or write about or expound or educate or share an idea. Like, what is the kernel that they wanted, that they were watering and letting bloom? And then they wanted to share it with others. They wanted to share it with others, right? Of course, Timothy Leary, who's such a considered kind of controversial, he was just so taken with what it had done for him that he wanted to share it with the world. He wanted to invite others to give up their conditionings, right? So I can appreciate that so much about him.
Where my mind goes around that question is, I mean, I always go back and think to the really complex and beautiful concoction/compound. And this is a little dark. I'm going to go a little dark here, that has been created to create zombies. And it's basically a compound that creates a twilight sleep for several months in human beings, and used for, it's a very dark practice. There are lots of books that have been written on it, but of course, science has gotten some of the compound and it is so complicated and complex. There is a little bit of a, I don't know what to call it, like, but a compound from a fish. There's a compound from several plants. It's so intricate and in its own way, very beautiful. Even modern science, I say even modern science, but they're like, how did humans even come up with this? Like, who would have thought to put these different, seemingly disparate, like so far removed from each other, chemicals together to create this twilight sleep in a human being? And in my mind, I just immediately go to, oh, the plant spirits told someone, probably hundreds, if not thousands of years ago, do this, put this together. You know, it was a connection with the natural world or some sort of, I mean, someone who was born who had an immediate connection with plant spirits or the natural world, who was able to converse with them and was able to be taught. And that's where my mind goes. So even the ayahuasca brew, which I think, you know, in my mind, I could never come up with something like that, something that transports people or teaches people, helps people in so many different ways. There was a teaching somewhere, right? Back lost in antiquity, that original person who the plants decided to teach and say, hey, maybe if you mix these things together, yes, it will actually help everyone. Right. But that's just where I go.
Right. Well, and then you wondered to yourself, what was going on for that person or around that person that caused them to seek putting that, ingest maybe that plant medicine or to synthesize something and put it into their own body and try it, right? Because we are part of our environment. We're animals too, as human beings. We forget it all the time that we're animals.
I'm going to say it was because there was no TV.
And smartphones too, right?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, it's true. Well, there is a lot of dulling, right? You know, there's a lot of dulling, and Ken Wilber, of course, talked about this a lot in Up From Eden about the, you know, the kind of impulse inside the human being to seek transcendence on some level, and how that got this kind of Western dissociation. It's a term that Ken Wilber used to describe how the Western parts of our culture became enamored with false enlightenment, right? And that was money, power, belongings, acquiring things, possessing things. And those things became substitutes for seeking wholeness in the spiritual realm.
Thank you. Thank you for that. Cause I think it's something that, you know, again, it's like us daily wandering through this field, right? That the fish don't know they're in water. We don't know that we're walking through this field. We have no idea that we're every day living in this conditioning that is all pervasive and affecting a lot of what we do, what we say, how we think. So thank you for that. Well, I would love to hear any stories of magic or miracles. Anything that you would like to share that you're comfortable sharing. Everybody has a different interpretation. So whatever you feel comfortable sharing, one story or multiple stories, I'd love to hear it.
Sure. Well, I don't know why, but this one is coming up for me. And it comes from a very early journey over 10 years ago with ayahuasca. And in that ayahuasca journey, it was probably my second one I ever had. And I was sobbing so much that I had snot running down all my face and everything. Of course, the room is really dark, right? And it was maybe my first or second it was my second experience. And I was so unable to move in that moment in time that I couldn't even reach for a tissue, right? And that can happen in that space. And I remember that one of the helpers came by and he gave me a tissue. And I remember holding it up like a fan. And I was like, what is this? I was really in an infant state in that moment in time. And I finally figured out to wipe my face. And what came to me in that journey was a vision and a conversation with my mother's mother, my grandmother on my mother's side. And she had come as a bride to my grandfather from an educated family, which was rare at the time. Her father was a translator for the railroads in the West. And had disappeared. And when he disappeared, all of the daughters had to be married off out of the family. She was the eldest? She wasn't the eldest. She was the youngest daughter. So they were upset because she wasn't a boy. And when what she told me and what she showed me is her birth. She showed me what it looked like in the room when she was born. And she said, I came out and I saw it through her eyes. And this transmission was so real. It wasn't even words spoken to me. It was a knowing that what she experienced in that moment of being born was that she was not wanted because she was a girl. And inside her own consciousness at that moment, her first thoughts at that time, her first feelings were, I better be useful. And I just wept and wept and wept when this was shown to me through her eyes. And I really, at that point in time, went on a very, very deep journey of undoing conditionings. It became really my core mission in my life for myself, and one of the central tenets of what I hope to hold. Of course, I would never impose on any client I'm working with, but that is there. All of the conditioning. And so through the years, there have been many, many times when I have seen this deconditioning or undoing of these layers of lacquer for myself. Certainly in 2021, when the women were murdered in Atlanta, I went through it again and actually had to undo another huge piece of conditioning that was in my marriage, actually, as an Asian woman, how I had been conditioned as an Asian woman by my heritage, by my cultural heritage, by the Western culture context, by my female context, by my Chinese context, by my Chinese female woman, you know, as a Chinese woman in marriage, and what that looked like in my marriage. And luckily, I'm in a marriage that my husband was completely open to that, but he could not understand the conditioning because it was something that we had lived with. We'd been married 10 years at that point in time, you know. So it's really, I'm really thankful for my experience with that medicine and what it showed me. And those mystical experiences like that, I'm so thankful. That's all I can say.
Well, and there's some seriously profound healing that can emerge from that, you know, because they talk about, I mean, I know the science of epigenetics is very, it's still being debated. It's not resolved. I mean, they thought they had it resolved, and then there's more discoveries that come out, but it absolutely, you know, makes sense that trauma stories, all of that stuff, because right. For example, lots of religions talk about the ancestors.
Yes.
And the stories that they have to tell us or that they watch over us, or that what they experienced is relevant for us, resonates still. So in that way, I do think epigenetics is onto something, because it's basically giving a Western language around what all these other traditions have been saying forever. And what a heavy burden for her to carry. I mean, like a baby coming out of the womb, and that's the first message.
That's right.
It just breaks my heart and makes me sick to my stomach, because every baby should just grab it, cherish it, love it up.
Right.
You know, right. Tell it it's precious, but yes. That's not something that can just, I guess it doesn't, I mean, it obviously doesn't happen all the time, but what a thing to carry, to have to kind of work with in your entire life. But that kind of thing, that story, I'm sure it affects your DNA. It affects so much. Absolutely. Your neural conditioning, everything.
Absolutely. I mean, really, it actually made me very much understand the basis of where shame came from for myself, at least from my own cultural context as a female Asian child. And that intergenerational transmission of you shouldn't exist. You're taking the space of a male child. That, right, because of the one child rules, right, that were going on, you know. And in that same journey, then I was shown so many places in which in my own life where I had lived with the supposition that I was a burden and that I had to be useful, and realizing how many places I did that, and really just stopping stopping the pedaling, stopping the taking the foot off the gas pedal for any of those places. And that was how I undid it. Thankfully, I had many other supportive practices and support, other supports in place to integrate that vision. And what I mean by integrate that is to undo and do something differently.
Yeah, a part of me thinks that this whole addiction to, you know, Netflix, our phones, computers, the internet, it's all this giant experiment to keep us from healing ourselves, to distract us so that we don't go deep, so that we don't see the injustice, so we don't see the privilege. So we're just skimming along the surface of life, because skimming along is easier, right? It's less work. It's less energy. You don't have to cry. Not a lot of crying. Not a lot of demands on the ego to potentially see things from other people's point of view. Right. You can just kind of float along like a little dandelion seed, never land anywhere.
One can curate that dissociation as well. Absolutely.
Yes.
And it always fascinates me when my clients are in that place where they are ready and they're choosing to not float along right anymore. Yeah. Something that comes up in my client sessions a lot is I often do have to warn my clients that come to me. I say, you know, I am somewhat carefrontational. I am carefrontational, and I will confront patterns where I see them. And it's something that is particular to my style as a psychotherapist. And I don't know if other therapists do this. I'm sure they do. Everyone's got their different styles, but there's something about that's very important to me, because again, coming back to metaphor, I imagine that, you know, we're all tending our own garden. And what do you want to do with your garden? If you've invited me to come tend the garden with you, then I'm not going to stay silent. You've asked me to come tend it with you, right?
I want my garden to be full of watermelons because they're delicious, and lots of little plant spirits so we can have good dynamic conversation, and then octopi because they're so fun and interesting, and we can play hide and seek because they can camouflage themselves.
Yes.
So that's
awesome if we could have octopi in our garden. They're so cool.
I think they secretly want to be in the gardens, but they just haven't figured out a way to leave the ocean yet.
Well, I think we do have our own Southwestern version of them. The other day I was weeding my garden and I almost disturbed a snake. I didn't realize I had a snake living in my garden. I'm thrilled there's one in there though.
You're so lucky. I love snakes. Snakes, so spiders show up for you, snakes show up for me all the time. I mean, this is not going to be in the podcast, but it's so funny. I went to Arkansas and I've had, you know, I've had some really interesting and non-believable interactions with animals in my life. And based on this interaction I had in Cornwall, when I was walking the Camino, I was walking on this very sterile city park in this city in Arkansas. And I was just walking. And then all of a sudden it was like, go sit down on that bench. And it was almost like a dare. Go sit down on that bench and something's going to happen. And I was like, okay, whatever. So I sat down and it was right next to this culvert that was probably about 10 feet away. And I sat there and I turned my head and this giant snake came out of the culvert. I don't know what kind it was. It was gray and it was long. It was so long. Wow. And Arkansas has so many snakes. And it came out, it raised its body like 2.5-3 feet out of the culvert, like looked all around at the world. And I was like, oh my God, this is happening. Is it poisonous? Does it see me? Don't move. And then it just went down and went back in the culvert. And I was like, okay, that's what I was supposed to see. The lesson is snake.
Wow.
So yeah,
it's supposed to be about creativity and creation, right?
Yeah. And transmutation, like you know, if just change, like your life's going to change, you're shedding the old skin and stepping into something new. So yeah, snake in the garden is a good thing. And they're so, you know, they get such a bad rap. It upsets me. Like, it's so unfair. They don't have legs. First, unfair. Second of all, like, everybody's terrified of them. Poor little nuggets.
Yeah, they do get a bad rap, but I think those who are open to the idea of magic miracles, right, of transmutation are open to seeing the snake, right? You know, those that are, because right, when we're embracing transformation, that's when we're undoing the layers of lacquer. There is something that's going to die inside of us. We're going to shed.
And let me tell you, that process is super fun.
Super fun. Super, super duper fun. Super duper fun.
We should pay for it because it's so fun. Was I lying when I said this interview was super fun and also educational? I'd like to give a little shout out for Amy's book that's coming out next year, along with her co-author, Shin Yu Pai, Small Doses of Awareness, a Microdosing Companion Guided Journal. You can find it on Amazon and reserve your copy right now, but I urge all of you just to check it out because there's a lot of incredible things happening in the plant medicine world, including these courses and classes that Amy is crafting for Southwestern College. I need to thank Amy for being such a fun and interesting guest, and then I need to thank the creators of the music used in this episode, Sasha End. I love his music so much. Sometimes for certain episodes, I just use the gorgeous stuff that he creates. Please remember that it takes a village to get this podcast out into the world. So consider sharing the podcast with those you love, even with those you don't love. And also, please consider writing a review or leaving a rating wherever you find the podcast. Those ratings and reviews are so important because they help other people find us. I'm ever so grateful for the reviews and the ratings I've received so far, but because we all know that the hustle is real, I'm asking for more. Thank you for listening, and here's my one request. Be like Amy. Do the deep work to find your authentic self. Know that despite your best intentions, despite our best intentions, that this society and this culture, you know, they're telling us stories about who we should be, who we must be, how we don't have choices. And I know that in all of us, or most of us, there are these little hidden pieces, these hidden delightful parts that are just waiting to emerge into the world. So be like Amy and commit to the process, knowing that with the difficulty, with the engagement, a more beautiful and a more authentic you will eventually emerge. And I don't know if you'll find this interesting, but I've had some golden teacher mushrooms for like 2 months now, and I keep looking at them and, you know, wanting them to invite me.
Yes. Yeah.
And I just, and they haven't given permission. And then, you know, this last week I've been like, okay, I'm in like the perfect place. And I had a dream the other night where I was in this kind of labyrinth and like underground thing that looked kind of fleshy and stuff. And I was getting a tattoo on my back and I was like, okay, I guess I'm getting a tattoo. And then the person finished and I was like, I looked around and the person, by the way, was like this thin blonde guy with like a thatch of like his blonde hair was spiking up everywhere. And he's like, oh, look at it. And I look in the mirror and I'm like, oh my God, that's like literally not where the tattoo is supposed to go. And it was like this tattoo of like a blonde bubble or a bubble that was misshapen. And inside were two mushrooms. And then the blonde guy who was tattooing me was inside there also. Oh. And I was like, okay, that is amazing. And it was on my left rib cage. Wow. And I thought, I think maybe this is the invitation. I'm going to take this as the invitation because now I'm literally branded with tattoos and mushrooms. So, I've tried to be very respectful, but you know, reading that book, The Wild Kindness, you know, they have whole ceremony and, you know, they talk about it, but they also don't go into detail about the ceremony, which I think is amazing as well. But I thought, you know, you have to approach this stuff with respect. You can't just like go barging in. Absolutely. So is that me like legitimizing my mushroom taking to you? I don't know. It could be. I'm trying to let you know that I'm respectful, but.
Well, I think that's the hardest part is knowing whether you're getting a message from elsewhere or is it a message from the mind or some other part of us?
Yes.
I think that's really one of the most interesting parts of being in relationship or in a psychedelic experience or choosing to partake in a psychedelic experience, right? Is whether or not you're intuiting or hearing some sort of conditioning, right?
Right. You
know, right. And because we're always trying to see through all the conditioning inside of us. Me involved, me as well, every single one of us. I say this to my clients all the time. I'm like, oh yeah, I just undid some conditioning last weekend. I'm continually, it's like layers of lacquer.
Yes.
And
it's totally true.
Yeah. We don't even know we're sniffing that air. We're swimming in that water until we have another experience. And I think that that's really what ceremony and experiences like with psychedelics can do is they put us into a completely different state of mind. And then when we return to our regular daily life, our default life, right? Then our default mode goes, oh yeah, well, you can snap back into it, right? And that's why always, you know, I think that's why such modern guidance on how to actually not feel like time is moving so quickly and not to feel so overwhelmed is to unplug from all of these default things like our cell phones, right? And by the way, I just had to put mine on silent, right? And turn it over so it doesn't distract, right? Because that droplet of moment of time that we sink into, and you know this because you know you're a religious studies scholar, right? Mm-hmm. That the depth of going into just one little thing really deeply, it's like a whole universe, a whole cosmos can show itself. Right. So, yeah, I love that sort of thing. And if I can remember to keep that, it's great. But sometimes I kind of feel like I'm that character, like Lucy and Ethel in that famous scene where they're packaging up the bonbons and they just keep on stuffing it in their mouth because she can't get into the box in time. She starts to give up. Right. I always laugh at that because that's how life really feels certainly for me and maybe for a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I love that scene. Cause as a kid, when I was watching it, I was like, that's my dream job. And I would probably pretend that I can't keep up with putting the bonbons in the box just so I can shove them in my mouth.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then at some point it kind of almost becomes too much, right? Because the most wonderful thing about chocolate is when it melts on your tongue. You get to taste it. If you don't get to taste it, it's really not the same, is it? Right? Yeah.
That's so funny. I love that you know that scene because I think about it every once in a while about it's so like, especially for our modern world, right? That I doubt back when they filmed that scene, they could have any concept of what the world looks like today.
Yes.
How perfectly it illustrates just what we're all trying to do right now. then, you know, I also love how you talked about just, I mean, for me, when you said it, it flashed, oh, that field that we're always walking through, right? That we're surrounded by, which, you know, in science, they talk about the Higgs field or the Planck field, that fish are swimming through water, but they don't know it's water because it's right. It's the reality. They don't understand that.
Yeah.
We're all moving through something that we have no comprehension of because it's our reality. So how do we unpack that and connect to it and go deeper, dive into it, start a relationship with it? I think about that all the time because, you know, I think when people talk about miracles or magic or whatever, that field is probably one of the places where a lot of that stuff emanates from or emerges from.
Yeah.
And you know, certainly plant medicines have the ability to connect us with that.
Yeah. I think Michael Pollan's books and his series really open the door to all of that. Really, I mean, to the mainstream, because he made it so accessible for people to understand it. And he made the science, you know, the neuroscience understandable, talking about the default mode network, made that understandable. And you know, in ways that that's really great. On the other side of things too, because of, you know, my role as taking on this role as the certificate program director of psychedelic studies at Southwestern College here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, the thing that all of a sudden comes to the forefront for me is, you know, there's amazing opportunity and promise, but then there's also possibly places where people could get harmed, become harmed, whether it's by a facilitator or by maybe their own overexcitement about what the promise is, right? Because we can be blinded when we want something, any of us. I know I can, for sure.
It's part of being human, I suspect.
It absolutely is part of being human, right?
Yes, yes.